welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Varsha.
And today on the show, we have... Varsha did her first ever interview with historian Nicole Hemmer. And y'all, it is so fucking good.
It was so much fun to do. I'm so happy she said yes. Like, I emailed her a couple of weeks ago, right? And she said yes. And I was like, oh my God, I get to email a historian that I love. This is so weird.
It gets so nerdy. And like I said on Monday, like, they nerd out so hard. It's so great. But before we get to that, and it is an excellent interview worth listening to, we had to edit it slightly for time, but the entire unedited interview with all of the, like, juiciest, nerdiest bits is up on our Patreon. So if you're a $5 and up subscriber, you'll be able to listen to the whole thing. And it's real nerdy, y'all. But before we get to that, we are going to talk about the government losing track of migrant kids because the story keeps actually getting worse, which... is not surprising, but still fucking disgusting. And on top of that, we're also going to talk about immigrants in natural disaster areas, especially with Hurricane Florence and the sort of difficulties that are coming up there. We also are going to talk a little bit about Trump's declassification spree and why that just feels so wrong. It, like, feels very... there's something very off-putting about the whole story.
Yep.
And yeah, so packed show as always. I feel like I say that every single time. And just a reminder, we have our two other shows went up on Tuesday. So we have Crush the Midterms, where we spoke with Flippable CEO Catherine Vaughn about local races. And it's kind of theme week here at Hellbent, because for candidate, we also spoke to two women who are running for local office and why... like the power of local politics. So those are both really great shows. I always call the candidate, the Emily's List one, like my warm and fuzzy hug, because it's so uplifting. So if you need a break from the deluge of bullshit, these women are just so incredible.
It's so amazing what Emily's List has been able to do and what these women are going to do. Is like, it's so clear that the fall is going to see a huge increase in the number of women who are in office, and that can only be good. Okay, Devin, what is the latest news about migrant children?
So the government has lost track of about 1,500 migrant children. So basically what that means is when children leave shelters and they're released to, they call them sponsors of some kind. So a family member or someone who is willing to take them in. The government is supposed to know where these kids are going and check up on them and make sure that they're safe. So they have lost contact with 1,500 kids. That is so many fucking kids. I can't express how awful that is. I mean, it's awful that we have 12,800 children in custody as it is, but this is also not a new thing. We also reported on this a couple of months ago, when another report came out that they had lost contact with another 1,500 children. So this is a lot of kids who have, we don't know where they are. And I think what's really frustrating about this too is that they're saying this is really, really worrisome because we don't know if these kids have been released to people who will harm them or, you know, who are working in human trafficking. We don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's like, just as we talked about last year, because there's initially some confusion when this story came up, and this is a similar one to one last year. It's like, there are cases where we may not want the government to be like so in the know about where these kids are because their parents or their sponsors may be undocumented, or maybe the person, somebody in the house may be undocumented, right? But at the same time, 1,500 is a high number, and it is the job of the Department of Health and Human Services to know where these kids are, right? So like ICE should know where these kids are, but HHS should, in a normal administration where HHS isn't trying to deport every single person.
That's actually a really good point. Just because HHS knows where they are, which they should, doesn't mean immigration agencies should know where they are. And I think separate that. And I think people forget that we can separate those two. But what's, you know, kind of the theme of the last couple of episodes where we've talked about this is the government has no process in place to take care of these children, to keep track of them, to keep them safe. And, you know, and then they started talking about, again, I think last week we were talking about the government wanting to implement a fingerprint system and do more intensive vetting and background checks to sponsors who are going to take these kids. And it's obvious that the fingerprint system is just to scare undocumented relatives. Because yeah. if they really, I mean, they obviously don't care, right? They obviously have no misgivings about these 1,500 children. And, you know, Caitlin Oakley, who's a spokeswoman for HHS, said, quote, as communicated to members of Congress multiple times, these children are not lost. Their sponsors, who are usually parents or family members, and in all cases have been vetted for criminality and ability to provide for them, simply did not respond or cannot be reached when this voluntary call was made. But it shouldn't be fucking voluntary.
Yeah, I feel like they should have a better system as to check, okay, this person that we gave this child to is like definitely related to them, is definitely like completely vetted, and it's fine if they don't respond to our 1 month phone call. But there's another group of people where we weren't 100% sure. Like, they should create a system, right? Like, literally every single company has a system to manage projects, right? We have a system to manage our episodes. Every single company has a system to manage projects. And this is a huge fucking sensitive ass project. You have kids in your care and you are giving them to sponsors, and most likely those sponsors are fine, but there are tiny chances that they're not fine, and you should have a system to check that, and a system that makes it not mandatory, and a system that makes it comfortable for people who may have undocumented people in their household or whatever to respond to you, because all you should care about is the kids, not deporting these people, right?
Exactly, so exactly. And I think that goes back to your point about the separation between what HHS knows and what immigration knows, because if they really cared about these kids, then they would make it a priority to know where they are and to basically just leave the immigration officials out of it, right? Like,
yep.
But, and the thing is that they're not applying all of this sort of safety of the children shit that they're giving us evenly. Because on Monday, we talked about a case where a man could not be reunited with his daughter because there was a 15-year-old alcohol-related charge on his record.
Yeah.
And they said, well, no, you can't be reunited with your child. And at the same time, they don't know where 1,500 kids are.
Bullshit.
Bull fucking shit. This isn't about keeping kids safe. And it just could not be more clear here.
Yeah. I mean, this is what's so frustrating about this administration. In so many different ways, they make it clear that they don't care about people who aren't white and American, right? Right. In so many different ways. And this is just one of many ways they're making it clear to Americans, they're making it clear to the world, and they're making it clear to these kids that, no, we're not, literally, that's what they said, is like, we're not legally responsible once we release these kids. And I understand that you're not legally responsible, like, I'm putting huge air quotes here, but you should be ethically responsible, right? If you are going into a job where your job is going to be to take care of kids, like, either that's in foster care or you're a teacher or whatever, you have a certain, like, level of ethics, right? And so the fact that this HHS spokesperson can say, oh, these kids aren't lost, she's like 100% confident. You shouldn't be 100% confident. Like, if you really were 100% confident, this story wouldn't be in the goddamn news, right? Because you would have found a way to be confident. You can't just be confident with no evidence to back it up. And that's basically what's happening here. They ran an experiment, and their hypothesis is, oh, these kids are fine, but they have no evidence. They didn't do anything to prove that these kids are fine.
Also, you know, we talk so much on here, Varsha, about intended policy outcomes,
mm-hmm.
and how sometimes this administration, a lot of the time this administration, does not have any intended policy outcomes, or they have policy outcomes that they didn't expect. And just let's go ahead, for the sake of this discussion, say this administration wants to curb immigration and wants to get undocumented people out of this country.
Mm-hmm.
Then shouldn't it be of the utmost importance that they track the undocumented children that they're releasing into sponsors so that they can get them out?
This is what
Do you know
I'm
what
saying.
I mean?
At times, their racism doesn't actually match with their goddamn policy choices, right? Like, if you really wanted to be fucking racist, you would do a better job. If you really wanted to be racist, you would make sure to all these immigrants that are in detention, you would just release them with their ankle bracelets. And that way you can know that they would come back for their court date and then deport them. And you wouldn't have a bad PR nightmare. And you wouldn't be spending millions of dollars detaining children and families, right? That's what's so frustrating at times, is that like their incompetence in how they want to enact these policies is so breathtaking. And at the same time, it's so clear they're like malevolent and evil, and they just want to like hurt people, that at times they make choices that hurt people more.
Right. And it's just, it's cruelty. It just really speaks to the fact that this isn't even necessarily about undocumented immigrants. This is about creating this ethnostate and the white nationalism that's powering this behind it.
Definitely. And don't tell me like we may not have enough money. Like there might be like some stupid Republican on Fox News being like, oh, we don't have enough money to make sure we can keep track of everyone. Like HHS is strapped for cash. We just added $17 billion to the budget for the military. So like, fuck off.
Right. Fuck off. And, you know, your little tax cut for the rich really increased our deficit. So spare me that bullshit narrative.
Yeah.
So I on a similar vein, in terms of what we were talking about with the separation of something like HHS and immigration, you know, with Hurricane Florence, and this happened with Hurricane Harvey as well, a lot of undocumented immigrants who are in the paths of these natural disasters are afraid to get help and are afraid to use the government services to seek shelter and food and refuse because they're worried about being deported.
It's really, really frustrating, because like I think that the Trump administration, at least certain people within the administration, have made it clear that, oh, like ICE is not going to be, conducting business, like, or, you know, conducting raids or whatever during the recovery or during Hurricane Florence. But we don't know for sure. And we don't, and they're not in an environment, like the past 2 years have created such an environment where people who are immigrants, unauthorized or not, are just afraid of Border Patrol. And they're afraid of ICE. It's not a system where they can go to them for help. If like, let's say somebody from CPB or ICE or whatever is helping with the effort, or they're using some of their materials, like a truck or whatever, it's going to create panic in the community. And that's like the underlying problem here, is that the Trump administration has made it so easy to create panic that it's going to be difficult for maybe some immigrants to get the help they need.
Right. Well, and the fact of the matter is that, like you said, it's about panic. And they're also sending mixed messages here. So I said they are not going to conduct enforcement operations in areas that are affected by the storm. But the associate administrator for FEMA, Jeff Bayard, said, quote, "I'm not going to use the terminology guarantee. We are going to help any human that needs help." But I mean, so he said, we're not going to use the terminology guarantee, but we're going to help people. But he denied to answer a question about whether or not FEMA was coordinating with federal immigration authorities. So just a heap of contradictory messages. And I don't know, if you're already scared, something like "we're not going to say guarantee" would terrify me. Yeah. Just fucking terrify me. And like you said, Varsha, there's this increasing fear, like a culture of fear that's happening right now, where, you know, immigration has stepped up the arresting undocumented immigrants and for no reason, and for pushing deportation on people who before were largely left alone by these agencies. And so the coupling of those two, you know, you have to make a choice. Like, do I seek help and shelter and risk being deported, or do I try to ride out the storm? That is not a fucking choice that people should make.
Definitely. And I think what's another thing that's compounding this is the transformation of the Republican Party over the past few decades towards immigrants. So like the concern, like The concern is also coming from the governor of South Carolina, where like his name is Henry McMaster, and he is a Republican. And basically, he has backed a law forcing city and county governments to prove that they were working with federal authorities to arrest and deport undocumented immigrants. So already, undocumented immigrants in South Carolina have been living in a community of fear before this hurricane, because their, you know, their governor, their state house is basically trying to find ways to work with the federal government. You know, well, in California, like Jerry Brown is like, fuck that, like fuck ICE, right?
Leave me the fuck alone.
And also, like, federal prosecutors in North Carolina were issuing voting record subpoenas, as we remember, because we talked about
that. That's right. That's right.
And so these two states are like the worst place this could happen. Like, obviously, this is the worst for any state, any community, because it's a hurricane. But this is like distinctively bad for immigrants. And so was Texas, right? It's distinctively bad. And that's what's really frustrating about this, is that they were already in a community of fear nationally and on the state level. And this is just going to add to that. And this is going to make it so much harder for them to receive the help that they need. And if they do, excellent. But the fact that the government cannot guarantee that the focus during a hurricane relief, like recovery, like period, is going to be like deporting people is so depressing. It's so depressing, because there's a lot of farm workers in these two states as well, because they're major, the main thing that they grow is like tobacco, right? So there's a big population of undocumented people there.
And I think, I guess, just want to ask again and again, we have no answers. But to what end?
Yeah.
Why? Why force people to live in fear like this? And I do. I understand the answer. I understand the unique cruelty of this administration. But I don't know, especially when we talk about natural disasters and the already completely botched response that this administration has had to previous disasters. Just, is this what you're focusing on?
Yeah.
Like, you've got to be fucking kidding me.
I mean, I asked Dr. Hemmer a really good question about like historical analogy and like how people should be using history to understand, right? And she was like, it's not as much historical analogy as historical analysis that's important to understand the past, right? To turn hindsight into like foresight. And so if you are analyzing the past, in the past, when we've used techniques like this, they began with a community of fear. And then they turned into like real enforcement and real like the long arm of the state, like fucking over families, right? So if you look at Japanese internment, if you look at the Red Scare, it began with this like culture of fear that was intangible. And then you saw these tangible results. And that's a way to look at this. And I don't mean to say that as to like say, oh, this is like a direct Nazi analogy. No, this is about like how authoritarian governments that want to control families in different ways than like we have controlled families before, you are going to see this type of intangible culture begin first, and then you see the concrete results of that.
All right, Varsha. So I want to talk quickly about Trump declassifying information related to the Mueller probe. So can you kind of take us through what is going on there?
Yeah. So last Monday, Sarah Sanders released a statement. Basically, she said, quote, for reasons of transparency that, like, you know, the Justice Department or President Trump has asked the Justice Department to declassify a whole bunch of materials regarding the Russia investigation, which is the investigation into his own fucking campaign. But basically, the materials he's trying to declassify or wants to declassify are sections of the Carter Page FISA application. Only sections, not like the whole thing, which is weird. FBI interviews relating to Page, as well as FBI interviews with Justice Department official Bruce Orr. The real like problem with this, though, is that Sarah Sanders says President Trump has directed the Department of Justice, including the FBI, to publicly release all text messages relating to the Russia investigation without redaction of James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, and Bruce Orr. So basically, the president is asking to release an enormous amount of internal material without redaction about an ongoing investigation into his own campaign and his own associates. I know because it's 2018 and Donald Trump is committing crimes out in the open that we don't really realize like the gravity of what's going on. But picture this. Richard Nixon, in the dead of night, calls up the Justice Department and says, hey, can you send me the notes on what's going on with your the special counsel investigation? Like, what are they up to? And the Justice Department is like, oh, yeah, we'll take it under advisement, right? And then it comes out, like, months later that Nixon had access to all of this. Like, that's what's happening here. It's as if Ronald Reagan knew everything that was going to happen in the Iran-Contra affair in terms of what they were going to investigate and what the Senate was going to ask and what the House was going to ask and who they were going to testify and what these people were going to say before it all happened. That's what he's trying to do. He's just trying to figure out the mindset, and he's trying to get the public to figure out the mindset of these investigators so he can mess with the investigation. That's what Donald Trump is trying to do.
Right. And the fact that the DOJ, you know, they said that they're saying, okay, well, he said immediately, but what we're going to choose to believe is that he said, start the process immediately.
Yeah.
So they're kind of hedging here. But the fact that they didn't say, go fuck yourself, is really indicative of the time that we're living in right now. Because the Department of Justice and the executive branch, because of Nixon, are supposed to be completely separate. And they're fucking not. And it's wild. And I think people don't realize how out of control that this is. I mean, they declassified a FISA warrant application. That is not a thing. Declassification of FISA materials is not a fucking thing. And again, we see this time and time again, the shunting of democratic norms and this playing with the line between lawfulness, like what is legal and what is just precedent. And again, if we start to completely regard precedent, I'm not saying that precedent is always right,
yeah,
or that the laws that we make are always correct, or the decisions the government's made has made is already correct. I think, you know, the fact that FISA is so locked up tight is a problem. Mm-hmm. But instead of going through the proper channels to say, okay, we need to fix the FISA court, he's just like, oh, well, Christopher Steele, P-tape, Carter Page, FISA warrant. That's it. That was the entire logic behind it.
He's like, how can I take like a search engine to all of these documents and just release the stuff that'll be damaging to Robert Mueller or to the Russia investigation as a whole? And that's what he's doing, right? So that's what, like, because, you know, Wired had a story about like the collateral damage to these declassifications. And they actually quoted somebody who works at the Cato Institute. And so remind you, like, Cato is pretty conservative, but on the other hand, they're also pretty really focused on like individual privacy when it comes to the state, like doing investigations on its own citizens or monitoring its own citizens. So like, you know, Cato argues that, yeah, obviously the FISA process is secretive, but selectively choosing what to like release isn't going to solve that problem. And also in the future, like, let's just assume this is like nothing specific, but let's assume like President Bernie Sanders in 2024 has like an investigation into him for whatever, right? And he goes, oh, well, Donald Trump released all of these documents from FISA court. That means like there's precedent here for me to just call up DOJ and release whatever the fuck I want to mess with the investigation, right? That's like one aspect of it. And another aspect is how the men and women who are in the intelligence community think that some future president at the drop of the hat is going to release their secret texts, or not even their secret texts, maybe their emails. Within those emails, there could be process information. There could be ways, there could include like ways and means they're doing their job, and that could put them in danger, right? So this is being done at a total disregard for what law enforcement and the intelligence community does. And it's also being done at a total disregard for individual privacy. And it's also setting horrific precedent. Like, that's the three things that's happening here. And finally,
so it's a triple
like
punch. It's a triple punch in the face.
Yeah. And then there's also like a fourth thing, which it's an attempt to discredit Mueller, which I just think is hilarious, because Mueller is like the best fucking like PR guy for himself that I've ever seen. Like, never seen a white dude like hold himself so well. I'm just saying, right? Yeah. Like, he, no matter what, has found ways to protect his investigation and to just do his fucking job. And he just hasn't talked. There's no leaks. He hasn't talked to anybody. It's like he's, like, not afraid of anything. It's almost as if, like, he didn't ditch out of serving in a war and the president right. did, right?
Right. Almost like that, huh?
Yeah, because, like, basically, like, I don't know if we talked about this when you were talking about Manafort, right? But the Manafort plea is pardon proof in the sense that, like, Mueller already got the information from Manafort, like, whatever Manafort's going to say. So even if Trump pardoned him, it's like, okay, whatever. I got the info. I got the dirt on you. It doesn't really matter, right?
I'm not saying every precedent is worth keeping, and I'm not saying all laws are right or even legal or constitutional. But what I am saying is that, you know, we've created some of these processes for a very distinct reason, and the separation between Department of Justice and the executive branch is so important. Mm-hmm. And so the correct response from the DOJ, the words they're looking for, is fuck you, Donald Trump.
So I'm Varsha, and with me today I have Dr. Nicole Hemmer. She is a historian at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia, and she is an expert on American politics and media, and she works on a wide range of projects, both scholarly and public. She also writes for Made by History, a Washington Post blog, which I read religiously, as well as being an editor at Vox, and she writes a column there, I think every other week as well. And then she's the author of Messengers of the Right, which is a book on the history of the conservative media, as well as the creator of A12, which is a 6-part series on Charlottesville. And Dr. Hemmer was reporting on Charlottesville, so she experienced it firsthand. Dr. Hemmer, welcome, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and so I am a historian as well, a historian in training, and my second year in my PhD. And so I was just wondering, how did you choose your PhD topic, looking at conservative media personalities from the 1940s?
So I cast around for quite a while to try to figure out what my dissertation topic should be. I actually started at Columbia thinking that I wanted to work on the progressive era. So back at the end of the 19th, early 20th century, I actually came across the history of conservative media a little randomly. So I was a research assistant for Michael Flam, who was working on a book about police violence and urban uprisings in the 1960s. And particularly, he wanted to look at news coverage of the Harlem riots of 1964. And so as I was paging through back issues of The Nation from that year, I stumbled across this article called Hate Clubs of the Air. And it was all about conservative talk radio and its political influence. This was stunning to me because I didn't actually know there was conservative talk radio in the 1960s. And so I had taken a copy of that article and then shoved it in a drawer and forgotten about it. And then when I was in a research seminar, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write about. And yeah. I was kind of frustrated. So I came back to that article and started looking through and saw that Clarence Mannion was named in there and that he had some papers in Chicago. And that sort of started me down the path.
Wow, that's really cool. I mean, the same thing sort of happened with my current research seminar topic as well. So I love hearing other historians' stories. It's really awesome. Yeah, so besides learning about Mannion from his writings in Chicago, I was just wondering what you found most surprising about writing the book, or what you found most interesting in making your argument. Like, what was the most frustrating part or the most surprising part about writing Messengers of the Right?
So I think the most surprising part was how much resonance so many of the issues I was writing about really had with the present. Because I guess I didn't really know what to expect. When I first went into Mannion's papers, I realized that he and his cohort in conservative media were really important and were really influential within the conservative media. But I didn't anticipate that so many of the themes that still structure our conversations about conservatism, the media, the Republican Party would sort of make themselves known in the archives, whether it was liberal media bias or the sort of central role that media has played in conservatism since the 1940s and 1950s. And I guess the other thing that was surprising to me is that when I first started this project, I thought it was kind of a niche interest because there weren't a lot of other people at Columbia who were fascinated by Rush Limbaugh and listening to Glenn Beck. It wasn't.
Yeah, that makes
sense. Yeah. It wasn't until I really sort of dove into it and started talking more broadly about what the project meant that I realized that there was something that was really resonating with people and that it would be a book about, if not an important book, then at least a book about an important topic.
Yeah, that's always a great feeling as well. So that's really great. So now to Charlottesville. I listened to the whole thing a couple times just to make sure I got everything. And you start with the fact that, you know, Vox had asked you to report on it. And I was just wondering, like, what was the experience like reporting on Charlottesville? Were you there for a couple days before or were you just there on August 12th?
So I actually live in Charlottesville and had actually been traveling. I traveled a lot through 2016 and 2017, covering first the campaign and then the aftermath of Donald Trump's election. And so I just really arrived back in town a few days earlier from a stint of travel. And August 11th, which was the day that the alt-right marched on the University of Virginia's campus,
yeah,
was actually a day that for me was a really calm and casual day. I'd gone for a massage. I went out for drinks with friends. And I knew that the next day was going to be a big deal. I have lots of friends who are activists or involved in politics here in Charlottesville, but I hadn't actually been involved in all of the discussion and the debate that happened in the buildup to August 12th and the rally that day.
Yeah.
I woke up that morning to the sound of helicopters, which is a pretty unusual sound here in Charlottesville. And that's when my editor reached out to me and asked me if I could go down and cover the events of that day. I didn't really know what to expect. I took my glasses just in case I got tear gas and had to take my contacts out. And I brought a little reporter's notebook and my smartphone and just headed downtown. I definitely was not prepared for the scene of chaos and violence that was already unfolding by the time I arrived.
Yeah. Wow. And so you begin with the fact that there's sort of like a memory hole that you're dealing with from how you got to the scene of the car crash to the safety of the downtown mall. And I was just wondering when you were there in the middle of this protest, some people, like I think John Mason at University of Virginia has argued that there was a lot of police inaction. Did you see that on the night before or the day of? Like, do you think that's still a problem? And do you think the Charlottesville police has dealt with that since then? Is there mistakes?
So it was definitely something that I noticed that day. And in fact, was one of the more shocking and, if I dare say, radicalizing things that I noticed that day.
Yeah.
Just because I, as a white woman, have never had really the experience of police completely abdicating their responsibility in my presence, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like they, when the police said to clear the area or people would be arrested, I thought the police would start arresting people. And when I saw really vicious violence taking place in front of police officers, I thought that they would intervene. And when I saw a peaceful protest carried out by Black Lives Matter, I thought the police would be like, oh, great, finally, a peaceful protest. And instead, the police officer that I had been passing by suggested that these were the real troublemakers, even though we'd already witnessed some really extreme violence in Emancipation Park a few hours earlier. So it was stunning. And I would say that in many ways, they have learned perhaps the wrong lessons or have just reiterated the same mistakes in different ways. And what I mean by that is one of the big things that I took away from my understanding of talking to people and reading reports about what happened last summer is that police really saw the anti-racist protesters as the enemy.
Yeah.
And in Charlottesville on the anniversary, where there was a tiny, if any, alt-right and white nationalist presence, the entire city was locked down. And The police presence was overwhelming. And once again, it was really aimed at anti-racist protesters. So the response was very different this year in response to the lack of police intervention last year. But the mistakes, the thinking seems to be the same.
So you said that the police were more focused on seeing the anti-racists or the counter-protesters as a threat. Has that been true since then? Has there been no discussion maybe in city council or with the current, with the police chief? Have there made any changes?
So there has been a lot of discussion about this issue, but we haven't seen a ton of changes. When there are protests at city council or now school board meetings, we continue to see the protesters being arrested or treated with, if not excessive, then an unusual amount of force and shows of force. So I think that it is an ongoing issue in the city that people are just going to continue to try to work on. I mean, policing, as you know all too well, is a problem across the United States, and Charlottesville is working out its particulars, but there's still a long way to go.
Did you end up answering, at least for yourself, your question about whether or not Thomas Jefferson, because you begin with Thomas Jefferson, right, and Charlottesville has so much to do with Thomas Jefferson, whether or not Thomas Jefferson is like this figure of natural rights, or if he's this figure of white supremacy? Like, as a historian, like, where do you end up standing on that?
So I actually think he's a deeply contradictory figure, and he is both the Thomas Jefferson of the Declaration of Independence, and he's the Thomas Jefferson of Monticello and slavery. And in many ways, I think the more interesting question is how those two things intersect. Jamelle Bouie, who is a national political reporter for Slate, who writes a lot about racism in the United States, has written a lot lately about the way that the Enlightenment and these Enlightenment ideas that really shaped Thomas Jefferson's worldview helped to establish the particular system of racism that we have in the United States and that we have in kind of Western thought more broadly, that those two things aren't separate, that Thomas Jefferson's sort of natural rights worldview is the same worldview that helped to construct ideas like scientific racism in the United States. And thinking about the way that those two seemingly contradictory ideas actually intertwine, I think makes Thomas Jefferson an important figure to understand if you want to understand the history of race and racism in the United States.
Yeah, that's really good historian's answer. Thank you. I think that the reason I turned to Thomas Jefferson is like the next big aspect of Charlottesville's history is being, being a city in the South where there was a majority Black population for the longest time. And then during Jim Crow, a lot of these monuments to the Civil War, these Confederate monuments are put up. And I found the episode about taking down these monuments one of the most fascinating episodes, because initially there are some people for it and then they change their minds. I was just wondering, like, when it comes to whether or not you believe that these monuments should at this point tell a story about, like, tell a more complicated story about why they were put up and what they represent, or if they should be taken down completely, like, where does the town stand? Where does the state of Virginia stand? Where do you stand as a historian when it comes to these monuments?
Sure. Yeah, that was actually one of the more fascinating questions that I got to follow in this series, because so many people who are quite well-intentioned, who understand white supremacy, who understand history, like historians, were changing their minds back and forth and back and forth. And we see that with a lot of historians, even outside of Charlottesville, who have been grappling with these questions for some time. So the city has voted and had voted more than a year ago to remove these statues. There is still a state law in Virginia that prohibits the removal of war memorials. And so this is being fought out in the courts. And if you were watching the 2017 elections here in Virginia, which led to a massive blue wave in the state house, you know, there's a good chance that the state house changes enough in the next few years that that law itself might end up being revoked and cities will be allowed to take out these statues if they choose to.
And so, speaking of white nationalists, this story obviously centers around a lot around them, but obviously you don't interview them. And I really, for one, appreciated that, because I think we've had too many interviews of white nationalists. But you mentioned that you've been looking at the alt-right for a long time. What is the most difficult thing about reporting on the alt-right or even studying them? And what do you see that is like distinct about this alt-right specifically versus, you know, previous conservative people on maybe the extreme side?
Sure. So I think that one of the more challenging things about studying white nationalist and the alt-right is that it's a pretty brutal scene in a lot of ways. Like, there are disturbing images, there is shocking language, there's something very uncomfortable about the way that the alt-right, sort of the alt-right worldview, and also the way they target people who write about them. So there also is this kind of frisson of danger or around reporting on them. Certainly before I published my first piece on the alt-right, I made sure I had two-part notification on all of my accounts so that they couldn't be hacked. And there is sort of this extra sense of vigilance that you have to have.
Because some of your interviewees saw like a straight line between the KKK and the alt-right today. And I'm just wondering, as a historian, do you view that straight line as like that analogy as useful, or do you think it belies something about the alt-right today? Like, it frustrates our image of the alt-right. It makes it harder for us to understand if we're just thinking of them as the KKK.
Sure. I think there is a straight line between white nationalist movements of the past and the alt-right today. But I think that it's really important for us to distinguish these particular historical moments. You know, there was this big debate back when the alt-right first emerged on the scene about whether we should even use the term. Why don't we just call them white nationalists? And in the midst of that debate, I argued very forcefully that we need to retain a sense of historical specificity, because the alt-right itself comes out of a particular historical moment in the late 20-aughts. It's a rejection of a certain form of conservatism, an embrace of white nationalism, but also that comes with particular trappings around tech and social media and memes that's really important to understand. It has roots in the men's rights activist movement. And Gamergate movement, absolutely. And so all of that stuff doesn't necessarily distinguish it from the sort of ideas of previous white nationalist groups. Like, white nationalist groups have always been patriarchal as well. But it does help us begin to understand how they're situated in a particular historical moment. And that's actually why I really loved interviewing Kathleen Ballou, who's written about white power in the 1970s and 1980s, because she's doing that same kind of thing. She's looking at what changes in the white power movement, what it is distinctly, what its networks look like, how its tactics change, while still preserving the basic sort of core white supremacy at its heart. And those kinds of ideas, the scientific racism, all of that, really do serve as a link. So it is both of this historical arc, but also has its own defining features.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the biggest issues that I was dealing with when I was listening through it, because I was remembering what it was like the days after Charlottesville, because I was watching from California, mm-hmm. was whether or not the protesters did the right thing in confronting, right? Is it better to ignore, or is it better to confront? And then I also had the same issue dealing with whether or not the media did a right job of interviewing these people. Is it better to confront and try to like debunk their views on the air, or is it better just to ignore them? Right. And I was wondering, like, if you could talk about those two types of confronting the alt-right in terms of protest and in terms of the media. What do you think each should do after doing your reporting on it and this podcast? Like, what have you learned?
Yes. So I was pretty persuaded by one of the people who I interviewed, Jelaine Schmidt. So Jelaine Schmidt, who's a professor here at the University of Virginia in the Religious Studies program, and who also is a Black Lives Matter activist, I found that these interviews with activists showed that it was important to visibly and visually confront white nationalists, right? Because what they had been looking for were these kind of photo ops, right? Where they have their torches and they surround these statues and they claim that space for themselves. And one of the things that Schmidt argued was that, you know, we have to make sure that in any photos, if any images of their presence here in Charlottesville, that there are also visible signs of protest, that people in Charlottesville did not accept that these white nationalists spoke for them. And I thought that was a powerful and persuasive argument. When it comes to the media, I'm not saying no journalist should ever interview a white nationalist, although I think it's better done by not in live interviews, that it's usually better done by print journalists. And I think that in most cases, we're better off interviewing experts about white nationalists, because what white nationalists are looking for is a platform. They want to be able to spread their ideas. And so when NPR sits down with Jason Kessler, who is the organizer of the Unite the Right rally, and allows him to, even with pushback, to spread lies about what he believes and what, you know, sort of like white civil rights are and those kinds of things, like, I think that actually feeds the agenda of the alt-right and white nationalists. And so I tend to object to that. And I tend to object to the kind of journalistic coverage that is driven largely by fascination with the trappings of white nationalists, and doesn't necessarily grapple with their ideas in a sort of hard-hitting kind of way.
Final question was sort of just going to be around the role of history in 2018 and what you think the role of historians should be. So do you think that historians should be more public-facing in 2018? You know, how useful do you think the role of, like, historical analogy is? Like, is it useful for, you know, Kevin Cruz to be tweeting about how this is very similar to the Nixon era? Or is it doing more damage to how we understand history?
So that's a great question. I would say I have long been an advocate of historians being more engaged with the public. So I'm very pro that. And I think especially in this period in which, you know, there's so much talk about things being unprecedented, when people feel genuinely confused about what's going on in the world, historians have a real role to play in helping to explain, you know, what's different, what's the same. And I think that gets to your second question, which is about historical analogy. I think historical analysis more than historical analogy would be useful here, and is something that we need to continue to press for, because simply making an analogy, like looking for historical antecedents to Donald Trump, it's not always the most useful or insightful thing, in part because I think that in trying to make those analogies, it's very tempting to kind of tilt or warp the history a little bit to make the analogy work. And that's understandable, right? That's part of creating narrative. That's part of writing. It's something that happens when we lean a little too heavily on analogy. But I do think that, you know, looking back at previous presidential scandals and corruption, so looking at things not just like Watergate, but like the Iran-Contra affair, and looking at how some of these things end in resignation and how some of these things end in you becoming like this lionized presidential hero, that there are no sort of, like, history doesn't just repeat itself, as we know quite well, but it can inform the way we understand the possibilities of the present. And I think that that is a role historians absolutely can play in this moment.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen, like, a lot of really great op-eds by a couple of historians, like, talking about their topic and how, like, how it fits into what's happening right now. And I feel like that's a great way to look at history, is like, this is what happened, this is how I interpret it, and this is how you can use it to maybe understand what's going on right now, or maybe understand how what's going on right now is totally different. I think that's what's really useful about history. And I feel like talking about that more in 2018 really also helps people who don't know what historians do, like, better understand what we're doing here. Because I feel like—
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I'm teaching for the first time this semester, and it's really tough to, like, get your students to really understand that this is an interpretive discipline, not just a discipline of memorization.
Yeah, I think that has been one of the great things that, you know, people out on Twitter, people at Made by History, people, historians engaging the public more. They're not just talking about history, but they're talking about historical process, and they're bringing to these conversations a historical sensibility that I think is another thing that we can offer to the public, and that can kind of crack open some of the mystery around what it is that historians do.
thank you so much for doing this interview. I really appreciate it. I was very excited when you said yes. Just so the listeners can know, you can follow Dr. Hemmer at Past Punditry on Twitter, and you can listen to her podcast, A12, which is a 6-part series on Charlottesville, the history and the aftermath, as well as she hosts a great podcast called Past Present Pod, which I know it's a very nerdy podcast, but it's a really, really great podcast to sort of understand what exactly Dr. Hemmer was talking about recently when, you know, you're looking at historical analysis and understanding it, using it to understand the present. So thanks so much for being here today, Nicole. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Varsha. This was so much fun.
All right, Varsha, what are you grateful for this week?
Okay, well, I'm grateful for a campaign ad. I know what you're thinking. You're like, why are campaign ads ever something you're grateful for? They're very annoying and bad, usually. But this campaign ad is amazing. It's historic, okay? So this is for Minnesota. In Minnesota, Dean Phillips is running for Congress. And he is running against a guy, a Republican named Eric Paulson. And this ad is Bigfoot talking to the camera about how he's never seen Eric Paulson. And then finally, he's like, wait, Eric Paulson, like, loves special interests. Like, maybe he exists there. And so he goes to, I don't want to spoil it, but he goes to, like, a lobbying firm, a big pharma lobbying firm. And then within minutes, he finds Eric Paulson and takes a picture. And it's a hilarious, like, it's a really important, like, political message, because what he's saying is, oh, this person is really easily accessible in a lobbying company, but hasn't been to his constituents. But also he's like having a really funny play on it by having Bigfoot find Eric Paulson. I don't know, man. It was a great ad. It made me laugh. It also, most importantly, made me look up Dean Phillips and be like, oh, okay, this is what this candidate stands for. If I was in Minnesota, I'd vote for him. Like, it's a fantastic ad. It's a great ad.
There's never been something that I've seen quite like it. And anyone who can integrate Bigfoot into a political ad is A-okay in my book.
It was hilarious. I mean, I feel like this, these kinds of ads, like the really emotional and really like amazing ones you've seen from women running for Congress, ads like this, like we're seeing these ads because there are new people who may have never held office before or may have never held national office before or are pretty unknown, that they're like, they're using their own creativity and they're not just relying on how it's been done all the time. And I feel like that's so refreshing and that's so necessary in 2018 because it's a shit show. So you need like a little laugh.
Although I do wonder, and this is just me speculating, if a woman running had an ad like that, if she would be mocked instead of lauded.
I mean, I feel like this is actually like a pattern is like we've seen there was Archie Parnell in South Carolina with this ad and a couple other ads. Men are able to run ads, or I've seen men who are running for Congress have run or talked about running for office in more humorous ways. And the ads you've seen from women are more serious. And they're still good. They're amazing ads, but they're like serious things about this is what's happened in my life. This is how my congressperson has betrayed me and like fucked us over. You should vote for me. Like it's a very powerful ad, but they're not as humorous, right? So that's an interesting dynamic, which sucks.
But I just do feel like because women have this extra burden of having to be authentic or somehow more vulnerable. Like the Bigfoot ad is funny, but it's also deflecting with humor, whereas women aren't really given that opportunity.
Yeah, we have to be simultaneously authentic and funny and awesome, but also serious because we are not up to the job, right? So you have to literally like this was talked about like nonstop when you talk about Hillary Clinton is that she had to turn herself into like a male version of herself. But at the same time, when she did that, people were like, oh, you're not authentic. And she's like, what the fuck do you want? Do you want me to like portray this experience that I really do have? Or do you want me to be like myself? Because if I'm myself, you didn't like me because you were like, oh, why is she making fun of women who bake cookies? And if I wasn't myself, you were like, oh, she's been in politics for too long. And I'm like, what the fuck do you want? Right. So that is problematic. But again, Bigfoot, what are you grateful for this week?
All right. So I'm grateful for this little story about Bert and Ernie. So I love Sesame Street. I watch Sesame Street a lot because I have a child and also because it's awesome. But, you know, the writer for a lot of the Bert and Ernie sketches, you know, is an openly gay man. And he came out and he said, like, when he was writing Bert and Ernie, he was drawing from his own personal experiences and his own relationship and sort of writing these characters in a way that felt familiar to him. So kind of the implication that there's like a queering of Bert and Ernie. And then PBS came back and said, no, Bert and Ernie are not gay. They're just friends. And that's fine. And I understand why they feel they need to do that. But even still, it almost doesn't matter what PBS says, because when the writer says something like this and the writer is just saying, like, I'm drawing on these experiences that were different from others and putting that into the story, baking that into the story, there is like a natural queering of those characters. And I also read something very, very interesting, I want to say in college, about Bert and Ernie and how, because Sesame Street was so adamant that Muppets don't have sexuality and Bert and Ernie are not gay, they really can push this queering of their relationship. Like, there was a cover of a magazine where Bert and Ernie were riding on a unicorn with like rainbows coming out of its butt. And that was completely acceptable because Bert and Ernie aren't gay, but it's obviously a very queer coded text. I just loved this story because it kind of reignited this discussion. And I don't know, it felt refreshing, even if PBS said, no, that's not how it really is. It just felt good to hear that the writer understands the queer subtext in Bert and Ernie.
Yeah. And I feel like for viewers, like for kids who are watching this, because the primary audience is kids, like PBS and people in general should not be worried that, oh, like if we show our kids like gay couples, like what will that lead to? It'll lead to them accepting gay couples when they get older. That's it. That's all it is, right?
Well, and there's also this, even though it's not explicit, children understand that they're in a relationship, and yeah, whether that relationship is romantic or not, they understand that, and just seeing that can lead to more acceptance than not seeing it. Am I saying it's perfect? No, but I'm saying that kids don't read the newspaper and they don't know if Bert and Ernie are gay or not, but they see them in a committed and quite frankly intimate relationship.
I thought it was adorable, but also it just made me admit that I, as a kid, related more to Bert than Ernie. I was just like, I was a little Bert. That was me. Okay, Devin, who is our Hellion for the week?
All right, our Hellion is Maisie Hirono, because she is the fucking best person on the planet. So she is on the Judiciary Committee, and she was asked a question by reporters that basically she's one of four women on this committee, and do you think it is important to have women conducting this investigation into Brett Kavanaugh? And then she got this look on her face like, that is the most boring and ridiculous question you could possibly ask me. And she basically says, yeah, of course it's important that women are on the committee, and it's of course it's important that women are conducting this investigation, at least in part. But it can't just be us. She said, men of this country, men in this committee have to shut up and step up. And it was just such a glorious moment. And she didn't hide her anger. And, you know, we talk a lot about female anger, especially women of color and their anger. And she didn't hide it. And she really called upon not just men in general, but the specific men on her committee, both Democrat and Republican, she didn't make a distinction there, to get their fucking lives together and stand up for this woman and what is right.
Yeah. She was literally like, she like stared Chuck Grassley like straight dead in the eye and was like, look at your life, look at your choices. What the fuck are you doing? Like,
exactly.
Because she literally said, after she said, just shut up and step up, she said, do the right thing for a change. And then I was watching the video, right, as it was happening. And then she's like, you can tell I'm a little frustrated about this. And I'm just like, oh, it sucks that she had to like have that, you know, aside where she's like, you can tell I'm a little frustrated, because she had to like qualify her anger. Her anger is justified and true and correct at this point, because basically the reason she's angry is that, Christine Blasey Ford, Dr. Ford, wants to have an FBI investigation into her allegations in Kavanaugh before she testifies, because that's how it fucking works. Like, if you have a fucking court case against someone and you're going to accuse them or something, you have to investigate it and then present your evidence, right? And the evidence is the testimony. And so she's like, hey, like, I want a full investigation into me and Kavanaugh and this whole thing that happened before I testify. And obviously the Republicans on the committee are like, I just really want to commit, I just really want to confirm an alleged attempted rapist to the court. Why can't you just let us do that? And so they're really like, they're being annoying and stupid and smearing this woman. And Hirono was like, no, this is nonsense. This is literal bullshit, right? And so she let that anger out. And I appreciate it so much this week, because this week, like, again, I wasn't alive during the Clarence Thomas hearings. I wasn't alive during the Anita Hill testimony, but I've read about it and it sounds horrific. That not only did she like express his anger, and she also like just made it really clear to me that the difficult thing with men in this committee and in this country is that they, for some reason, are always empathizing with the accused, like literally the alleged attempted rapist, instead of empathizing with the victim. And it's like, why are you doing that? Right. So they're like, Chuck Grassley was literally like, oh, like, I wouldn't want anybody to, like, you know, blame me for what I did 35 years ago. Like, first of all, you were like a senator and you were 50 years old. But second of all, like
you definitely should have. Yeah.
Why do you care about Brett Kavanaugh in this situation? He's not the victim here, right? He's not the survivor here. And that's what's really weird about this whole process for me, is how no matter what happens to a woman, people are empathizing with the man. People are empathizing with the perpetrator of the sexual assault instead of the person who like had to receive it and had to deal with it. Senator Hirono is like expressing that anger, and it's very, very good to see it.
Okay, Varsha, last but not least, what are some action items? So something that Hellions can do after they listen to the show.
Yeah, so I have two things. The first thing is to continue calling your senators about voting no on Kavanaugh, and also insisting on an FBI investigation into the allegations made by Dr. Ford. This is what she wants. She has just agreed to testify next week, or she's agreed to talk about testifying next week, as long as her safety is assured and the system and the process is fair. And I feel like the only way we can make sure the process is fair as citizens is to continue calling our senators and tell them not to fuck up this system and fuck up this process.
Yeah, the fact that she has to worry about her safety is fucked up enough.
Yeah, she apparently has gone into hiding and has received multiple death threats. So of course she has, because this country is insanely horrible to women. But basically, like, because these voters who like Kavanaugh or whatever are so like sure that he's going to repeal Roe v. Wade to like, you know, save unborn babies or whatever, they're willing to threaten a woman and kill her. Like that's their logic right now. But basically,
well, I mean,
like,
it makes it tracks, because they don't care about women and they don't care about women's safety, because repealing Roe v. Wade is limiting access to healthcare. So they don't care about women dying. So making a death threat against a woman totally makes sense, actually.
Yeah, it really does. And so if Chuck Grassley comes back and says, no, Dr. Ford, you have to testify on Monday and Monday only, or we're just going to continue and vote, that's just him giving up the game that he doesn't care about this story or care about this woman's safety. And we need to pressure our senators to make sure they're making even more noise. Like, you need to make sure your senator is being like Mazie Hirono. If your senator is not like Senator Mazie Hirono, even though she cannot be replicated, she's one of a kind and amazing, then you're not doing enough. Continue calling your senators. And the second thing I was going to say is, after you've been listening to Crush the Midterms and Candidate, you should make sure that you are registered to vote. If you already registered, if you're in a state where maybe the voting laws are iffy or whatever, check on your registration. Make sure you're still registered. In most states, you can look it up online. Also, make sure your family is registered to vote.
Yes. If you go to hellbentmedia.com/action, there are voter tools. You can register to vote right from there. You can check your voter registration. You can get dates for all of the elections and polling places. So there are a lot of tools there that you can use. So like Varsha said, that's an excellent point. Check. Make sure. Purging is a thing. Not cool.
It is a thing.
Yes. Well, Varsha, that is it for us. Always a packed show. Your interview with Dr. Hemmer was fucking incredible.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun to do, and I'm so happy she said yes. And people really should follow her on Twitter and listen to her podcast, A12. But she also, like, A12 was just like a 6-part series on Charlottesville. If you want to hear her every week, there's Past Present Pod, which basically it talks about historical stories and, like, turns them into, like, foresight. It's a really, really great podcast.
From one nerdy historian to another. I love it.
Yeah.
So, Hellions, that is it for us. We will see you next week. In the meantime, you know, listen to Candidate and Crush the Midterms. Remember to subscribe and review us. It really helps get the message out. And yeah, have a great weekend. Remember to raise some hell and practice some compassion. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere. Thank you.